Poor Paul Rasmussen. He can't figure out why we're still in Luther. October 31st came, went, and why are we still in Luther? You know, it's kind of funny. Most people know probably two things about Luther. One, 95 Theses. What would be the other one? He wrote A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. But the other big event is probably when he stands at Worms and say, here I stand, so help me God, I can do no other. What we're going to be doing for the next several weeks, including today, is kind of lifting back the curtain and taking a look at parts of Luther's life that are not as well known but are absolutely critical, because what we're going to look at this week and next week are the things that actually turned Luther into the guy that we know, into a reformer. He's not a reformer October 31st, 1517. He will become one very quickly. So, last 2 weeks we've been exploring Luther's 95 Theses. Real quick summary, in case some of you weren't here the last week. They were prompted first and foremost because as an Augustinian monk, he had been reading St. Augustine. He had been reading particularly the anti-Pelagian works, of which there are four. And he begins to understand a new way of sort of grappling with or understanding the faith based on his study of St. Augustine that is very different from the world he lives in. The idea that salvation is about what God does, it is not about what we do, whereas in the medieval society, salvation was about what we do. We attend Mass, we have pilgrimages, we say novellas, the church had really stressed the role that we play in that. This study is going to lead Luther to begin, and we see this in the theses themselves, he's beginning to question some aspects of the spirituality of his age, medieval spirituality, and some practices. A particular sore point is this brand, and it is brand new, less than 10 years, we got this new practice of selling of indulgences so you can get people out of purgatory. And again, people start showing up in Luther's church saying we don't need to do penance, we do not need to feel repentant or confess or do the satisfactions because we have a piece of paper that gets us out of this. That's then aggravated when Tetzel, whose salesmanship is, shall we say, a bit extreme, shows up in the next town and people buy from him and they start showing up in Luther's churches. In the theses, as we've seen the last 2 weeks, Luther, first of all, does criticize the selling of indulgences. But he goes beyond that. He even goes beyond his stated purpose. Remember, his stated purpose is a disputation on the power and the efficacy of indulgences. Not selling, but do indulgences work? In the theses, Luther even goes beyond that. He directly challenges the authority of the Pope. Did that get real clear the last 2 weeks? There is no purgatory. He does not have the power of the keys. The treasury of the merit he draws on does not exist. He has no authority to grant indulgences to anyone living or dead, and Luther just rolls like a drumbeat. Which is a very good movie. Right, that's the...
Where the idea of salvation is what God does.
Yeah.
Is that wrong or not?
Well, that's a common understanding. Here's the problem with that. We have Luther's notes of his lectures on Romans. And we have his notes on his study of Augustine. And we've got his sermon. All this stuff was preserved. So what we know is that when he's teaching for 2 years Romans, and for 1 year, Galatians, between 14, 15, and 16, none of this theology shows up in those. But in his notes on Augustine, it does show up, which has led the more recent scholars to say, it looks like, even though he's reading Paul, and even though later, when he has his tower experience, it will be Romans 1:17, the just shall live by faith. That's it. And I'm sure that his reading of Paul is feeding into this. But what Luther says in his own notes, it's his reading of Augustine, in particular, Augustine's monergy. Human beings are not involved in the process of salvation. It is sola gratia, sola fide, sola Dei, God alone. God does it. So that's the best guess. You know, yeah. It, could there be some Paul in there? There could be. Yes.
One more question about purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
Was the concept of purgatory developed by the Roman Catholic Church so that they could have more control over the faithful and get money?
Purgatory actually goes back. Some of the roots of purgatory go back to the 2nd century B.C. and some early Jewish writings like 2nd Maccabees. And then in the early medieval age, that begins to develop. First, that there is a place for the dead. If you're not good enough to go to heaven or bad enough, you know, there was some thinking in there. And there are some scriptures that Luther would not find compelling, but there are some scriptures that definitely... So that's... By early medieval period, that doctrine is in place. What happens later is the church begins to weave that with some other beliefs into what you're talking about. But purgatory itself originally was just the idea of God is just, God is good. Most people are neither bad enough to go to hell or good enough to go to heaven. What would a just God do with that? God would give them a second chance. And there are some scriptures that say that. Not a doctrine of purgatory, but it's the foundations of a doctrine of purgatory. Okay. No. Good questions. Theses. So this is what we looked at last week. They actually challenge the very foundations of medieval spirituality itself. Because they challenge, what is it they challenged? Penance. The whole idea of penance, you know. He redefines penance in his theses, not as something done through the sacraments of the church, which is what the church says, not done by priests, because who says absolvo to you? Who forgives your sins? You confess your sins to a priest, and the priest says absolvo. You are forgiven, okay? Luther changes that. He defines it as something done not by the church and not by a priest, not by the institution, but by every single believer individually. This is before he's articulated the priesthood of all believers. He defines it as a life lived in repentance. So it's not a sacramental thing. It's an individual life kind of thing. Now, here's where the shoe drops. Less than 6 months later, a high official of the church, not a cardinal, but right below a cardinal, is going to accuse Luther to his face of, quote, turning all of Europe upside down with his thesis. What we want to do today is to explore the backstory behind that, you know, this six-month period. Here's the question. How does an academic set of theses written by a previously unknown monk in a backwater jerk town in rural Germany, which is exactly what everybody says Wittenberg was, how could that literally turn Europe, not just Germany, Europe, on its head and do so seemingly overnight? Is that a good, fair question? That's what we're going to look at today. And we're going to begin with a corker. There's an odd twist. If you've been reading books about Luther, this is true in pretty much all but two of the books that are out there. There's a misconception about Luther that's still out there in nearly all the literature. This is sort of a sidebar, but it's an interesting sidebar. You may know this. Many scholars today doubt whether the nailing of the 95 Theses ever happened. Are you aware of that? Okay, so that's gotten out. Okay, so I dodged that bullet. Okay, yeah. There's no doubt that he wrote them. There's no doubt that he distributed them. But there's been doubt as to whether he actually did this iconic scene in the clip art, which is always wrong at so many levels. What's the first thing you see wrong?
They're reading it.
Yeah. Ordinary people are reading Latin. Yeah, I'm sure it's going to happen. Okay, yeah. And we got a monk representing the church already going, oh, he's evil. And then some other, and Luther's, you know, look at his face. I've just started the Reformation. No, you know, okay, no, that's true, okay. Now, one reason for this doubt is that Luther never mentions it. Now, this is a guy who wrote books. If you want to spend several thousand dollars to get the complete set of Luther's works, we'll start at that wall and probably hit that wall. He's one of the most prolific writers in the history of the world. Never once mentions it. Okay. That's odd. If you think of it the way that we think of it, as having the momentous nature that we believe that it had. That's a hint that something's going on. That it's the event credited with... Why do we celebrate the 31st of October? The Reformation was launched. No, it wasn't. Okay. Another reason for the doubt is that the earliest reference to Luther's posting occurs 30 years later in 1546 after Luther's in the grave. It's shared by Philip Melanchthon, who is not even in Wittenberg in 1517 because he comes in 1518. He could not have been an eyewitness. So Luther never mentions it. And we don't have a single eyewitness that it ever had. Now, that leads historians, and remember what historians want. Historians want good, solid foundations, right? So if Luther never mentioned it, nobody mentions it, and the first guy that mentions it wasn't there, and it's after Luther died, it's probably, what's that fancy word, apocryphal. It's just one of those things like peasants reading Greek, you know, or Latin. Okay, yeah. Now, there is circumstantial evidence. We know that posting theses was a very, very common practice. Everybody did it all the time, you know. We know that in the 6 years between 1516 and 1521, Luther posted over 20 different sets of theses on the door of the church. How do we know that? He tells us. His colleague Karlstadt posted another 30. And Karlstadts are always longer. If Luther does 95, Karlstadt does 300. You know, just that's Karlstadt. But again, it's all circumstantial. Has not convinced most scholars. But, I did not know this this year, two new discoveries have just happened. As we moved into the 500th anniversary, people have been going over all this material, you know. It makes it very likely that, in fact, it did happen. Here's the first. 2006, a handwritten note by Luther's secretary, George Rohr, is discovered by, you know, anyway, you can Google that if you want to. The note explicitly says that Luther posted the theses on the door of the church October 31st, 1517. This is a quote from the note. On the evening before All Saints' Day in the year of our Lord, 1517, theses about letters of indulgence were nailed to the doors of the Wittenberg churches. There are four churches by Dr. Martin Luther. Okay, that changes things. Even more recently, an eyewitness account, somebody who was actually there and witnessed it, has been discovered, not known for 500 years, okay? Written by George Major, who later became professor of theology at Wittenberg. The note states that he witnessed the posting of the door when he was 15 years old. He was there. And that's something he wrote by hand and was put in something and had just been lost, but has been recovered. So, that makes it likely that the story is historically true. Now, we still have a puzzle. Why is such a momentous event? Why did Luther never mention it? The answer is probably because it was not momentous at the time, okay? It's likely because in and of itself, the posting of theses was a common, relatively insignificant event. And by the way, we don't have any record that anybody ever attended this disputation. Remember his other disputation on the scholastic theology? Nobody showed up. Best guess is that nobody showed up. He nailed it up. We're pretty sure of that. We don't think anybody came. So he's 0 for 2 at this point, okay?
It's like Ted Campbell said, I think he said he published 95 boring, but, you know, didn't.
Yeah. In Latin. Okay, yeah. Now, this observation sets up the story we want to tell today. The six-month period following the nailing of the theses, the period known as the print. I'd never heard of the print wars. Had you heard of the print wars? This is a big deal in Luther literature. I just did not know about it, you know. Okay, we're going to begin with this broad consensus. Contrary to popular perception, posting the theses on the door is not what started the Reformation. That begs the question, what did? That's the story we're going to tell. The theses are posted in Latin. Only clerics and scholars can read them. We have no record that anybody showed up. It's not looking good. Most likely, the theses was a non-event noticed by no one in the world. If Luther had stopped there, we would all be good Catholics, okay? We would all be good Catholics. What launches the Reformation is not that iconic image It's the theses themselves. It's the content of the theses. And it's also the way that that content becomes known to the world, because Luther did two other things that are not widely known outside Luther scholars. And these two things, 6 months later, a high prelate in the church says, turned Europe upside down. So that's where we're going. These are what moved the discussion out of the rarefied world of academic debate onto the world stage, which, by the way, it gets to very, very quickly. Now, that said, there's a third thing that's not mentioned in the PowerPoint. Luther did nail the theses to some of his friends, and some of them did begin to circulate them around. But again, they're in what language? And they're being circulated to professors. So this is not the thing. Some people say, yeah, it's the Gutenberg printing press. Yeah, it's still in Latin. It's still a handful of them, and it's still not what's going on. This is what the real story is. Okay. He sends them to several people. Most important for us is Archbishop Albrecht of Mainz. Does that name ring a bell? After today, it'll ring 4 or 5 bells, okay? He's the highest-ranking church official in the Holy Roman Empire. He's also the guy who authorized the selling of indulgences. Talk about poking the bull, you know? Who's Luther going after? The guy that got the whole thing started, you know? He sends his theses to Albrecht. He includes a cover letter giving additional. And by the way, the cover letter survives. Would you like to hear what Mr. Luther had to say to Archbishop Albrecht? Okay, this is about 10 slides. It's worth it, okay? First, he starts out with about this much flattery. Oh, I'm just another worthy worm. I'm a nobody little monk, Podunk, Texas, you know, and you're such a great omniscient. That's just, you do that in that day. This is where he gets to it. Under your most distinguished name, papal indulgences are offered all across the land, not just Etzel, all across Germany. For the construction of St. Peter. These are the Peter's indulgences we've been talking about. Now, I do not so much complain about the quacking of the preachers, which I have not heard. Has he heard Tetzel? No, he's heard stories of Tetzel, okay. But I bewail the gross misunderstanding among the people that comes from these preachers and which is spread everywhere among the common men. He's a pastor, and he's really upset about this. Evidently, the poor souls believe, and they have told Luther to his face, that when they have bought indulgent letters, they are assured of their salvation, which is contrary to church teaching and church law officially. And that as soon as they cast their contributions into the money box, souls fly. Where did that come from? That's a Tetzelism. Okay, it's a Tetzelism. Furthermore, that these graces, the graces conferred through indulgences, are so great that there is no sin too great to be absolved. Even as they say, though a thing impossible, and we're getting another Tetzelism here, if one had violated the Mother of God, the Virgin Mary, raped the Virgin Mary, that such a man is free through the indulgence from all guilt, and he's not letting that go, okay? He put that in the 95 Theses, he's putting it back up again. For this reason, I've no longer been able to keep quiet about this matter, for it is by no gift of a bishop who authorized them, Archbishop Albrecht. It's by no gift of a bishop that man becomes sure of salvation. To the bishop. In addition to this, most reverend father in the Lord, tongue in cheek, it is said in the instructions to the commissionaries that you wrote and you published and you gave to Tetzel and authorized Tetzel to do everything that he's done, issued in your name, that one of the chief graces of indulgence is that the inestimable gift of God, by which man is reconciled to God, and the word for that is salvation, and that all of the penalties of purgatory are destroyed with a piece of paper. How about that? Again, it is said that contrition, the first of the three things required in penance, contrition, confession, satisfaction, contrition is not necessary for those who purchase souls out of purgatory. You think he's a little hot. And who did he go after? He did not go after Tetzel. You know, prior to writing the theses, somebody had gotten and given to Luther a copy of Albrecht's instructions to the commissionaries. and he read it, and he was appalled. Okay. He's learned that all of the outrageous claims of Tetzel have been authorized by the archbishop himself. You know, Luther's not going to go with that. Yeah, Luther clearly lays the blame on Tetzel, but he lays the blame on the archbishop. Yeah. Now, no surprise here, Archbishop Albrecht is not inclined to hear with favor, but there's a hidden agenda here that's not widely known. Albrecht is selling indulgences because he has to. You know, he's under immense financial pressure. He's recently purchased a second bishopric. Now, according to church law, you can only be bishop of one area. He's now bishop of three. Okay. A couple things happen. Because this is scholastic theology, you can always find a way to do it, right? So it's against the law. But if you want a second one, you can, because this day and time, how did you become bishop of an area? You bought it. So you got to pay for the second bishopric, or it's actually the third, but the second one's kind of a weird deal. And you have to pay a fine to Rome to get around the law. So he is out 40,000 ducats. I know you're not up on your ducats, but just put it this way. You would not want to be in hock 40,000 ducats, okay? It makes him bishop of Mainz and Brandenburg. The problem is he didn't have the money. He borrowed it from the Futters, the wealthiest family in Europe. Without the revenue of this, by the way, he agrees with Rome to sell these indulgences, half of which go to Rome, half of which he keeps, for the express purpose of paying off his debt so he can be solvent. You know, if he doesn't sell indulgences, he's bankrupt and he's ruined. What? The Futters, F-U-D-D-E-R-S, wealthy family. In Germany at the time. They were they made their living lending money. And they were considered the wealthiest family in Europe. And they loaned money to princes and kings and popes and all kinds of things. With, of course, little interest. Okay. This is to say, selling indulgences for Luther is a theological issue. It is not a theological issue for Albrecht. It's an issue of survival. First of all, the indulgences are not selling well, which is why you have to ramp up the appeal. Now this uppity monk from nowhere is critiquing it, and people are listening, okay? So Albrecht responds, as any good archbishop was, he forwards the theses to Rome, along with his assessment that Luther is a threat not just to him, but to the Holy Father and to Rome. Because whose name was on the indulgences initially? Pope Leo the 10th. Okay. It's Albrecht who first identifies Luther as a threat to Rome and the Pope. It is Albrecht who sets in motion conflict with the Pope, something Luther never wanted. Okay. He's still a loyal Catholic at this point. The second thing that Luther did is going to have even more far-reaching implications. This is what's going to put Luther on the map and turn Europe upside down. You know, this other one gets the ball rolling in Rome with the Pope. But this second one is far more. It becomes part of a larger story that's called the Print Wars. I'm just going to walk you through the Print Wars, okay? It begins with Tetzel. Actually, it begins with Luther writing 95 Theses. But Tetzel is no dummy. Luther portrays him as a buffoon. He's not. He's a highly educated, very sharp leader in the church with several advanced positions. But he's not a dummy. He correctly perceives that Luther has attacked him, because Luther mentions five of the tactics that he uses. He threatens to throw that heretic Luther into the fire. Not an empty threat, because one of his positions is Grand Inquisitor of Heresy. So, if Luther can be charged with heresy and brought to trial, guess who would try him? Tetzel would try him. And Tetzel would get the joy of burning him, okay? Tetzel then responds by publishing a set of theses of his own, 106 Frankfurt Theses. I guess he wrote them in Frankfurt, and he had 106 things to say. His theses do two things, no surprise. He defends the Pope and indulgences, and he attacks Luther and everything Luther had to say. Tetzel's theses adopt the form and the language of Luther's theses, giving what Tetzel thought Christians should be taught. Now, there's an interesting little footnote here I didn't include. Tetzel is the only guy who's going to go up against Luther in the next 3 years. He's the first. He's the only guy who understands something very, very important. No, I'm going to save off on that because it's not quite yet. But I'll give you what it is. He's the only guy that figures out if you're going to go after Luther, you have to print in what language? German. Everybody goes after Luther in Latin. Okay. What he does is he says, remember Luther said, this is what should be taught. Christians should be taught. Christians should be taught. Okay. Tetzel, Thesis 1. Christians should be taught. Well, what does he think Christians should be taught? Christians are to be taught that since the papal power is supreme, assumed, and instituted by God alone, assumed, therefore, it can be restricted or amplified by no one but God. Luther, shut up. You're not God. You're above your pay grade in this. Luther's second act is to respond to Tetzel's attack. Luther never lets a slight go by. Okay, he's going to come back at you. And he follows up in 95 Theses. He writes one of the most influential works he will ever write that is so profound that you cannot even find it on the internet. It's referred to, but I could not find a single copy in that. It's called A Sermon on Indulgences and Grace. Have you ever heard of that? It's one of the most influential writings, period, whether Luther wrote it or not. If you're in the print industry, you know this. In the sermon, he takes the 95 highly technical, boring academic theses, he reduces them down to 20 easy-to-understand points and common, everyday language. And just the coup de grace, he prints it in German so that anybody can read it, making it available to all. In doing this, Luther is credited with giving birth to the modern print industry. Until this point, printing has been something just people do, academic, you know, very, very little has actually been printed. He creates a revolution in theological writing. At the time, the common view, we're going to actually have some quotes in a few weeks from now of people who actually say this, but here was the common view. Lay people should not handle theology. Lay people cannot handle theology. Theology is the realm of the princes and the prelates of the church and the professional theologians. That should handle it. So it was always written in what? Latin. So who cannot read it? And who can read it? Okay? That was on purpose. Okay? The Catholics keep making, or the his opponents in the church will keep making this mistake. For the next 3 years, they keep writing, thinking this, they keep writing in Latin and then wonder why nobody reads what they wrote. Meanwhile, Luther's going to be writing. Changing to German enables Luther to take the debate out of the academic world, make it public, and for the first time, it brought the average person into the debate, and the common person becomes, the common person starts discussing theology on every street corner in the empire. The sermon is immediate printing sensation. The world has never seen anything like this. By the way, if you can get one print run out of something and sell it, you're doing good, okay? This is the first mass market success in printing history. It goes through an unprecedented 25 printings, 14 in the year, 15, 18 in alone. Nobody has ever seen anything. What does this tell you? In German, 25 printings. Who's buying it? Anybody that can read. Anybody that can read is buying it. 8,000 on average. Multiply 8,000 by 25, and the literacy rate in the Holy Roman Empire during this century is about 5%. Every adult in Germany either had a copy he could read or his friend had a copy that he could listen to. It saturates the market. That tells you the need that's out there. People are hungry for this, yeah. He becomes a national, he's a nobody. Overnight, he's the number one leading figure in Germany, in the Holy Roman Empire. He's a national hero. His views are out there to everybody. Overnight, he's the talk of Europe. They're talking about him in Scotland and England and France. He stirred something. He's hit a nerve here. It's this sermon that you've never heard of. It's what turned Europe on its head and what starts the ball rolling. The way this normally works is you had to get a printer to agree to, for example, Luther never earned a penny for what he wrote. writers didn't get paid. So the deal is the writer was, the publisher was taking the risk and the reward. So printers are only going to publish something they think can sell. In Wittenberg, there are people who believe in Luther, so they start printing. When they hear stories of how well it sells, they're now printing in Augsburg, Heidelberg, Leipzig, Mainz, you know. Guess what? Nobody wants to read the other side. This is one of the great stories. People cannot like Tetzel. We're going to see. Tetzel can't find it. Tetzel's going to come back. Tetzel can't find a printer to print his thesis because nobody wants to read what Tetzel has to say. Who do they want to read? Luther. It's a phenomenon the world has never seen before. Now, he's not done. He responds with a real creative title, Rebuttal, against his sermon on indulgences. He responds to Luther's 20 points by listing Luther's 20 errors. Luther, everything you said was wrong. Okay. Unfortunately for Tetzel, again, public opinion has turned. Luther is the man of the hour. Nobody wants to hear him. Luther has already lambasted him, and people have heard it. He cannot get people to even print this set of theses. As a result, he dies a year later, a broken and defeated man. He's lost his ability to have an audience. He can no longer sell indulgences. Because once this is out of the bag, who's going to buy an indulgence from him? Nobody. So he loses his job, too. Print wars are not over. You know, I have a ring, ding, round two. Okay, we're going to up the ante here. They're going to ramp up. This is the guy you're going to need to know because we're going to come back to him again and again. Luther now, into the fray comes now the most formidable foe a reformer could have in the century. Johann Eck. He is a high-ranking church official. He's called a prelate. He's not an archbishop, but he's not a cardinal. He's above an archbishop. He's a prelate. He was a prodigy. He entered college at age 12. He's considered to be, across the board, probably the greatest scholar of the age and by far the greatest debater. Because a year later, Luther is going to meet this guy in a debate. He enters the print war by writing, at this point, this is where this gets humorous. This is two academics with way too much time on their hands. Okay. He writes an anti-Luther piece called Obelisk. Now, what's an obelisk? This is that black dagger. That's an obelisk. That's a mark a scholar uses to note an idea that's dangerous or heretical. So you put a little, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, okay? They're also known as daggers because they have, look, can you see how you get a dagger out of that? Okay, it's important to the story. Johann Eck punctuates his comments on Luther's thesis with daggers, okay? So he's going, wrong, 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 wrong to Luther, everything he said, just stabbing it over and over again. They're heretical, they're dangerous. Eck claims that by attacking the church's teaching and the church's theology and its practice, Luther has committed, and this is a quote, the heresy of the Bohemian Brothers. Have you ever heard of that? It's a biggie, okay? It's a reference to Jan Hus of Prague, a group that broke away. It's a serious charge. Hus is a Czech priest in Prague. A century later, he was burned at the stake as an heretic. So to link him, and by the way, Eck, a year later when we have the debate at Leipzig, Eck will again, very shrewdly, try to connect Luther with Johann Hus. Not to be outdone, Luther is going to respond. He prints a point-by-point refutation of these words titled Asterix Against X Obelisk. You cannot make this stuff up. Now, this is an asterisk. That's a mark scholar uses for points that are especially true. So what did Luther? Eck goes, dagger, 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 dagger. Luke goes, asterisk, 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 you know. Yeah. What's interesting is these were never published. This is a private tit-for-tat kind of back and forth with each other, just kind of digging each other, you know. It's a private matter between two scholars. Luther's not seen the last of Eck. What we'll cover next week is that Leipzig, he'll have to face Eck face-to-face, the greatest debater. It's going to be the show in Europe, the defender of the holy, true Catholic faith against the upstart heretic reformer. And it's going to be a spectacle, okay? But back in 1518, while Luther and Eck are battling in print, the print word spread to a second front. Luther is being formally investigated now, charges of heresy by the Curia in Rome. Remember, the theses were sent by Albrecht. The Vatican then handed them over to Sylvester Perez. He's a Dominican. Dominicans hate Augustinians. Augustinians hate Dominicans. Tetzel is a Dominican. Albrecht is a Dominican. You know, Vatican theologian here is another Dominican. Perez's job in the Vatican is to investigate and to prosecute theological errors and to prevent heretical writings from being published. And guess what he's just gotten a copy of? You know, the Pope gave him this. He immediately saw Luther's theses as an attack on papal authority. He joins the print wars, and he writes a response. He dedicates it to Pope Leo. His title is very revealing for what it says and what it does not say. A dialogue against Martin Luther's presumptuous theses on the topic of, not indulgences, the power of the Pope. There's a shift here. For Church in the Rome, the issue is not indulgences, the issue is pain. If you support the power of the Pope can grant indulgences and indulgences are okay. If you attack the power of Pope, it undermines indulgences. So the Pope is the issue. Unfortunately for Perez, he published the work in Latin. And into the ash dump of history it went. Okay. This is a mistake we're going to see his enemies, Luther's enemies, make over and over and over. Okay. Luther now responds to Perez's work by writing a work called Explanations. Ever heard of this one? Another biggie. 200 pages long, in Latin, dedicated to the Pope, sent to Rome. Now that tells you something. Does Luther care what the Pope thinks? Yes. You darn right he does. At this point, Luther is not anti-Pope. He still thinks, if I can just convince the Pope that all this is wrong, we can solve this problem. Again, he wants to make his case to the Pope. Unfortunately, this is one of the six monsters. This is the de' Medici Pope, Leo X. He's the sixth of the six monsters. The one before him was the worst. But he's not inclined to be schooled by what he referred to as an uppity monk. First, the Pope dismisses the whole thing as a nothing squabble between monks. And then he graduates to, well, this is just an uppity monk. Somebody slap him down, put him back in place. During the six-month period of the print wars, we see two things happening. This is sort of where we're ending today. One is that there's a clear escalation in rhetoric and tension. Could you see it? It's going up, okay. Within 4 months of posting the theses, people are not just reading them. Students in Wittenberg are burning anti-Luther works and attacking those physically who are against Luther. You know. On the other side, Luther is increasingly seen as a threat to Germany, a threat to Rome. Leaders in Germany, leaders in Rome, threatening to have him burned as a heretic. The other major development is there's a shift in the nature of the debate. Bye-bye the issue of indulgences. That's gone. We have graduated to a much deeper issue. Bye-bye penance. Bye-bye any of the theology that Luther wanted to talk about. We now have one issue front and center, the Pope and the Pope's authority. And this is where everything's going to focus at this point. Now, Luther still wants to discuss his theology. He's an academic. He wants to do so in a formal academic setting known as a disputation. He's going to get his chance. In the year following this, there will be three opportunities that Luther will have to defend his theology, first in his own order, the Augustine order, and then to representatives of Rome and the leaders in Germany. It's going to climax with Leipzig. Luther's going to face the most formidable and dangerous foe. He's going to go head-to-head with Johann Eck. These debates force Luther to do something Luther never wanted to do. He becomes increasingly radicalized. And the harder they push at him, the more radical he becomes. It's from these debates that the third debate, Leipzig, the man who walks out is Martin Luther the Reformer, not Martin Luther the Catholic. So next week, we want to look at the three debates, Heidelberg, Augsburg, Leipzig. And be prepared, it's going to get messy, okay?